today I have the chance to talk to Bhupinder Singh Bance, also known as Peter Bance, who is a Sikh historian, author, art collector, and Maharaj Daleep Singh archivist. In fact, his collection has been exhibited worldwide, including at the V&A in V&A Museum in London, the British Museum, and the Bard Graduate Centre in New York. He has written for The Times and the Oxford National Biography and is the author of a number of books, including the Daleep Singh's photograph album of Queen Victoria's Maharaj, Sikhs in Britain, 150 Years of Photography, Khalsa Jatha British Isles Centenary, and Sovereign Squire and Rebel, Maharaj Daleep Singh and Heirs of a Lost Kingdom. He's also appeared in many BBC programmes such as The Story of the Turban, Inside Out, Desi DNA, Britain's Maharaj, Sophia Suffragette Princess, and The Stolen Maharaj, Britain's Indian Royal. Now, I know that's quite a mouthful and it's quite an introduction, but first thing I'd like to say is obviously thank you for making the time to do this. I can imagine you're quite a busy individual, especially from the number of things that I've just read out that you've already done. So as usual, what I like to start with is getting to know a little bit more about yourself and kind of the person behind everything that we've kind of just like listed, really, like all of these books, all of these programs, and on top of it, I'm sure as we'll dig in later on, your collection as well. So before we do get into that, I'd like to just get to know a little bit more about yourself, your family background, and your upbringing.
Sure. First of all, thank you for inviting me to your platform. It's a real pleasure to be here and to talk to you. As for my sort of family background, my family originally came from West Punjab in Sialkot, Duska, which is now in Pakistan. And my family actually were one of the sort of the earliest Sikh migrated family to the UK. My grandfather came in 1936. So that was pre-partition. So our family presence has been over 80 years in the UK. My grandfather was a doctor. But like many of the early Sikhs who came to the UK at that time, the 30s, 40s and 50s, he took up the peddling trade, which many of the Punjabi community was doing, which was selling basically haberdashery and household goods door to door in the rural areas. So that's a bit about my grandparents. My father obviously was back in India at that time. My granddad brought him here. And my mum's side, also a very early migrant family. They came in the 1940s, just after partition. And my mum was born in the UK.
Wow. Okay. I'd love having these conversations because I get to learn kind of just how complex and complicated everyone's background is. I kind of always thought I was like the only one with a complex background. One thing though that I think that really got my interest was, so you mentioned your grandfather was a doctor, but yet when he came here, he had to essentially become a door-to-door tradesman. Could you just kind of elaborate a little bit on that? I guess that's because the UK didn't necessarily see your grandfather's qualifications in the way India did, or how did that work?
Probably not. It wasn't necessarily for the education side of it, but I mean, he was very—it's quite old. My grandfather's by that time, so he'd sort of retired from doctoring. But he used to come here because a lot of my other uncles were also in the UK in the 1930s, and peddling was a real profitable trade at that time. As I said, many of the majority of the Punjabi community, even Shaheed Udham Singh, when he came to the UK at that time, stayed with Punjabi peddlers and did peddling himself.
Okay, and I know that the our conversation is going to take us in all sorts of directions, but just paying some attention to this, the peddling trade and kind of how instrumental that was with the early Sikh settlers in the UK, I guess. Why was peddling and being a peddler something that most Sikhs did at that time? Like, what was the reason behind that being their kind of go-to occupation?
Well, I did want to elaborate more on this in my question later on when we talk about Sikhs in Britain, because it was a real influence and it was a real benefit for me of having this background to doing the Sikhs in Britain book. So it really helped me because I knew many of the old families in the UK who were here sort of pre-war. If you don't mind, I think that's something we should leave for later on when we talk about Sikhs in Britain, because that's it'll give it a good start to that subject.
All right, yeah, no, not a problem. Okay, so Let's just then continue with your kind of family background. And so your grandfather came over here, I'm assuming, for work, or what was the kind of the reason for your ancestry arriving in the UK?
It was for work. And he came because obviously a lot of his uncles and his cousins were also here at the time. And they were working here. So they came, he came with them. And obviously then partition happened, and many of the peddlers went back to shift their homes from west to east Punjab. And when obviously we were uprooted from Sialkot, my grandfather thought, look, we're going to India anyway, but we've got to shift the family. We've lost everything, all our lands, etc., in Sialkot. So we thought, let's shift the whole family to the UK. So I don't think there wasn't the intention of moving to the UK at that time. When he used to come in the 30s, it was just strictly for work. But I think partition caused him to rethink the rehousing of the family, and that's why the family ended up in the UK.
Oh, wow. Wow. I love listening to things like this. I could literally sit here all day and continue to and kind of prick your brain about these things. But okay, let's just move on from that then. So partition obviously causes your grandfather to rethink about settling, and then obviously the family's moved over here. Then just kind of moving the conversation to yourself, then how was your upbringing, your education, and how did that then feed into what you're doing today? Or kind of is the work that you're doing today more of something you didn't necessarily envisage yourself doing when you were younger?
Well, we've come from a very strong Sikhi family. My ancestors were with the Nihang Missile, which were Baba Deep Singh's missile. So all my sort of ancestors, more the Farla, they're all sort of Nihangs in previous generations. Sialkot is well known for the Nihang Missile. The Natha Singh Shaheed was an eminent general under Baba Deep Singh, and his samadhi is still in Sialkot. And Sikhi was very much instilled with us here, and I touched with all my cousins and our brothers and forefathers have all been Gursikhs. And so we was always told about our Sikh history. Even as a young age, my father would always tell us about our Sikh history. But I myself, although I'm a marketing student and I studied marketing, I always enjoyed history. And it was something I always read up on as a hobby rather than a profession or for academic reasons. So it's something which was always with me, but something I enjoyed as well as a hobby.
So then you obviously explained that you did a marketing degree. How did you then manage to kind of enter into the domain of Sikh history? Well, history just per se, but then also Sikh history. And then like for myself, I would say that you're probably one of the most eminent Sikh, the UK eminent Sikh historians that we have. So how did you go from a marketing background to this?
Well, it's quite a story because we had a university trip, a student union trip to Norfolk in the 90s. It was sort of the late 90s, I think 96 or 97. And we were going to Norfolk, and there's a few Punjabi boys which was in the group as well. And I said, look, on the way, because we were on the A11, I said, let's stop on at Helvedon, because it was on the route. And I always knew about it. Obviously, I'd never been there. And I said, it'd be just fascinating to see, you know, the Leap Singh's grave and maybe get a glimpse of Helvedon Hall. And so we stopped there. So I remember it's a rainy day. We quickly made a pit stop. Ran into the churchyard trying to find this grave, and we find it and photographs ourselves. And the intention was just to photograph myself there, and so we've been there and then jump in back in the car heading to Norwich. A local lady came up to us and said, a lot of your community visit the Maharaja all the time, and did you know there's a museum in the local town, which we were totally unaware of. And all I can say is, 30 minutes later, I was standing inside what I could call, I only call a shrine to the Leap Singhs. I found that this museum had been founded by Prince Frederick the Leap Singh, the Maharaja's second son, who had not only donated the building and the museum to the town, but he also gave a lot of his family collection so the museum could start off exhibiting. And me and my colleagues, we spoke to the curator, and it's the same curator who's there today. So he's been there around 25 years. And I asked him, I said, is there anything about the children? Because I never knew the Lieb Singh had children. It was all new to me. And he said, look, we haven't got any books on the children. We've got books on Maharaja Daleep Singh, which was the Michael Alexander book called Queen Victoria's Maharaja. And I thought, well, this is something that I should, you know, delve into myself, because I was so fascinated that Maharaja had married and had these had six children who lived in Norfolk. And I, as a British-born Sikh, had never heard of them. So I placed a series of ads in the local newspaper in Norfolk and in Suffolk. And it was like a letter to the editor. And over the coming months, I had an enormous, enormous response. Around 300 people replied to me. And these were people who whose family had worked for the Maharaja. There were people who were still around who remembered Bamba, Frederick, Sophia. Because you've got to remember, look, Bamba had only died 40 years earlier. Sophia had died, 55 years earlier. And Frederick had died just about 70 years earlier. So there were still a lot of people who remembered the Maharaja's children. And many of them wrote to me and said, look, do come and see us, or we have this and we have that and belonging to the Maharaja or his children. And I... And I started just for my own curiosity, started visiting them. I recorded some of them as well. And many of them brought out objects, photographs or books, etc., or gifts that the family had given to them. And they showed them to me and they said, look, no, it's of no use to us. You know, our children won't appreciate it or whatever. And if you want, you can take these keepsakes. And I started gathering these, and most of them just gave me the stuff, which was brilliant. Some said, look, how much do you want to pay us for this? And, you know, you can have this. And that's sort of where my collecting sort of the aspect of the Daleep story came into place. That's where I started compiling my collection of artifacts associated with Daleep Singh in the late 90s. And as obviously my interest grew, I placed more and more ads in the local paper, meeting more people. And I literally had a whole source of, folders full of letters and documents with information on the family, which nobody had known about. And if it wasn't recorded or written down, perhaps it would have been lost forever. And a friend of mine at that time said to me, look, Peter, you've done all this work. You really need to look at getting the work published so it's out in the public domain. And it took me around 3 or 4 years to find a publisher. I just wrote to all the publishing houses who I thought would cater for this particular market or this subject. And then all of a sudden, one day, just at home, this letter arrived from a major publishing house. Said, look, we're doing a series of various royal families around the world, and we're really interested in doing a book on the Maharaja Daleep Singh and his family. And I was just over the moon, and I visited them, and that's where my sort of journey began into writing and becoming an author.
Wow, that's kind of it is amazing. I was going to say it's kind of amazing. That is absolutely astounding. I think also for a lot of people listening, the fact that it was via ads in the newspaper that you initially started kind of your collection, I think it's just a brilliant example. I absolutely love it.
I mean, I had no intention of writing a book. If anything, I used to hate, if I'm honest, I didn't used to like reading as a child at school, as a student at school. And I never sort of imagined myself 10 years later to be writing a book, especially a non-fiction book, or a history book on the Maharaja's life. So yeah, it was a real turnaround of events.
I can well imagine. There's two things though that I find quite interesting that I'd love to ask you about is, what were some of the items and letters and kind of information that you first got hold of that I think would be of like kind of things that are really interesting, perhaps that most people may not be aware of? And secondly, what was it about the Maharaja that attracted you so much? Because obviously it just from even just the kind of the last 10, 15, 20 minutes or so that we've just been talking, it's evident that you've got a really, really big passion, and like you, just like I loved researching and reading and kind of being all historically nerdy. It's obvious that you really like what you do as well. So not only kind of what was interesting about your research, but what was it, or what do you think it is that makes that area in particular something that you find so appealing?
Well, I always, as I said, I always liked history, world history. So I enjoy reading. Even today, I like to read about different countries, about the Russian Empire and the Ottomans, etc. So I've always enjoyed history and watching sort of historical documentaries, etc. But at that point in my life, I had actually never been to India. And the Dalip Singh's history was an aspect of Punjab or Sikh history I could research without having to go to India. So I could do it right here in the UK, because the Maharaja lived the majority of his life in Europe. So this was a fantastic way for my personal journey to research a part of Punjab history, which was not in Punjab, if you know what I mean, because I'd never been to India at that point in my life. So I was doing some Punjabi history research. Obviously Dalip Singh's, is the majority of his life was spent here. It was very new, and just going to Norfolk, visiting these families, and it wasn't just about getting the objects, because that came obviously as I did my research, but it was more about getting the history behind that object and how they had it, and how they knew the family, or what their relationship to the Dalip Singh family was, and the personal anecdotes. And for example, I met somebody who said to me, look, my grandfather was really ill, had a spinal condition, and Prince Frederick bumped into him one day and inquired about him and said, look, I'll buy you the spinal chair. And he even sent my grandfather to America to get him the treatment. So here was a family who was totally indebted to the Dalip Singh family for what he had done. And he hadn't forgotten it, which was great. And these sort of stories would never have come out to the mainstream, because it's just a simple Norfolk countryman who's had assistance for a spinal condition. And for me, those little anecdotes, those little stories spoke volumes about the family.
That is absolutely amazing. Yeah. Just listening to that little anecdote that you've just shared, that's so encapsulates what gives you an idea of what they were like as people, let alone kind of as just historical figures.
I think the local Norfolk and Suffolk and East Anglia community really holds them in very high esteem, more than probably us Punjabi communities do. There's the communities are really indebted to some of them. There's obviously they are referred to as the super siblings in East Anglia, which we probably never heard that phrase there. But if you talk to people up there, they say, "Oh, the super siblings," because Frederick was a great benefactor to the East Anglia community. He was a historian, he was an archaeologist, he was a collector of local art, and he helped so many buildings, especially churches, from closing down, because at that time churches and historical buildings were out of funds for restoration. And not only did he fund restoration, he gathered funds for them. He did charity work to raise money, and he overlooked the conservation and preservation of any of the churches. And even today, I'm working on a lot of these churches, and we're actually getting plaques put on these churches to commemorate Prince Frederick's contribution to saving or helping this church. And in 2019, one of the finest churches that he saved was Thompson Church. They contacted me and said, "Look, we're doing a current day restoration work on the church, and part of that restoration, we want to install a memorial plaque to Prince Frederick, because he saved this church from closing down in 1913. And I helped design and I funded a memorial plaque, and we had, I've forgotten the name of the chap we had to come and open up. I'll have to come back to that part. But we actually had the memorial plaque unveiled at Thompson. And a great amount of local folk came down to see it, and it was in the media. So it just shows you how much, even today, how much people remember the family. And another one would be Catherine, who Princess Catherine is often forgotten, but She's actually referred to as the Indian or Punjabi Schindler because she saved so many Jews, Jewish people from Nazi Germany. And I, in the 90s and early 2000s, I bumped into families, Jewish families, who said, we owe our shared existence to Princess Catherine. If it wasn't for her, we would not be here today. And she basically saved many families and vouched for their safe journey, gave them funds and even housed them at her property in Buckinghamshire during the course of the war. So a lot of hidden history.
Yeah, you've got me really, you've got my interest and my curiosity now absolutely in a mess because I just want to pick your brain really about this, about Bamba really. So what, in the practical sense of things, how did she go about doing this? Because I think for me, like I did a history GCSE, I did history A-level, I did history at university. And time and time again, you learn about World War II, you learn about the Europeans, you learn about, you never really hear about anything outside, as I'm sure you're aware, the mainstream kind of European westernized narrative. Even for argument's sake, just the inclusion of black or Asian soldiers is, if I remember correctly, was just never mentioned. Just in practical terms, and how was she able to do this? What did she do? And how did she manage to evade ever being kind of caught up or kind of stopped or having some type of repercussion for what she was doing?
So Princess Catherine, throughout the late 1920s and the 1930s, was actually living in Munich, was actually living in Germany. So she basically lived in Munich and in Kassel. And it's during this time, just before things were really getting really bad in the late 1930s, and they knew a lot of the Jewish families were fleeing. And I'll give you an example of one particular episode because I've met this family, and the family is the Hornstein family. Their grandchildren are still around, actually. They live in London. And their grandmother went crying into her doctor's surgery. And just so happened that that day, Princess Catherine was sitting in the surgery because that surgery belonged to her friend, Dr. Schaefer. And the lady came in crying. And then when she left, Princess Catherine asked Dr. Schaefer, what's the matter with this lady? Why is she crying? And she explained to her that her husband had been captured by the Gestapo. And although he was a serving officer who had fought in the First World War and got the Iron Cross, but had been arrested now as he was Jewish, and she went to the doctor obviously for help. And the family story goes that the lady actually managed to speak to one of the senior Gestapo officers, and he said, basically, because your husband had served in the First World War and he was a decorated officer, if she could get someone to vouch for him and pay and basically fund a voucher him in England and or voucher him to get out of Germany and secure his ticket back, he would release her husband. So Princess Catherine said to Dr. Schaefer, "I'd be more than happy to assist." Told the lady to come and see me. And so that's what happened. She assisted Mrs. Hornstein, and the first person to go was Mr. Hornstein. And after 6 months later, once Catherine herself had arrived in England, she called for the wife and their two children to arrive as well. And I was lucky enough to meet one of the children about 20 years ago, a very elderly lady who I managed to tape. So I recorded her, audio recorded her interview. She sadly died now, but I became very good friends with her son, who's always, gives me a call and pops into my office, and we have long chats about his family history because they've got a lot of family keepsakes as well, which Princess Catherine had presented them.
That's amazing. I'm now really interested because I'm going to go away and look at Princess Catherine being in Germany. And then her interactions with what was happening then, because obviously I'm aware of what was going on in Germany, but from a completely European kind of like the build up to obviously Hitler becoming Chancellor in 1933 and everything that then comes on beyond that. But to hear that there is a descendant of the Sikh Empire in the midst of this is, it's kind of incredible, really.
Yeah. I mean, at one point, there were so many Germans or Jewish German people living at her house in Buckinghamshire that the local people in the village were actually getting a bit scared, thinking, where are all these Germans arriving for? Because we was obviously at war with Germany. And there's a lovely photograph, which I'll share with you, showing you some of the German people sitting around Princess Sophia and Princess Catherine at the dinner table, dining together. And one of them was Volgariov, who was actually a violin player who the princess had saved. And later on, he actually became very famous violin player afterwards. So, and I'll share the image with you.
Thank you. We've obviously mentioned Bamber in passing, and I think a lot of people will probably be more aware of her than Catherine because of her relationship and her involvement in the suffragette movement. But obviously, you're better placed to provide some context and information about that.
So all three sisters were suffragettes. So they're all part of the movement. They all supported the suffragette movement. And Sophia, obviously, in particular, has got more credit, I think, out of the three sisters because she was much more active, as in she would be selling the votes for women newspaper outside Hampton Court. And because of her refusal to pay taxes and her belongings being repossessed and then resold at auction by the bailiffs. So she got more of the suffragette credit, but all three sisters were quite heavily involved. But I first came to know about the princess's involvement around 2000-2001. When a lady had written a book called The Suffragettes, on behalf of the Museum of London. And she, Elizabeth Crawford, her name was, and she mentioned to me that there was a whole archive of material which the suffragette office sold when the offices closed down. And I actually managed to contact one of the dealers who were actually involved in the buying of the suffragette items. And when I spoke to her, and she said, yeah, there was a huge archive and the Museum of London bought all these images, but there were some images which were in really poor condition and they did not buy these. And one of them actually happened to be a portrait of Princess Sophia and Princess Catherine at a suffragette dinner, which I managed to buy from the lady. So I was really surprised why the Museum of London did not buy this when they bought the rest of the collection. So that sort of led my journey to find out more about Sophia and Catherine's suffragette journey. And I spoke to the descendants of many of their suffragette colleagues, and there were various letters in various suffragette letters which mentioned Sophia's activities. So this was well before people actually found out about the suffragette movement in modern times, because it all had been pretty much forgotten. And then obviously Anitra Nund wrote more about the suffragette movement and Sophia's involvement later on, which was great to see that the Sophia story was actually told.
No, definitely. Now, one question that I think a lot of people are probably thinking, and I think it's an interesting topic just generally, is how did the descendants of Mardar Jinjit Singh Ji identify and view themselves? Because everything that you've kind of described so far, so Frederick's helping to restore and keep churches running. You've got the sisters all involved with the suffragette movement, even to the point where they're losing their belongings and they're being auctioned off, etc. Obviously, by this point, Punjab has been under British rule for quite some time, and partly the reason why they're there is because Maharaj Daleep Singh Ji was brought over. But kind of, could you perhaps elaborate a little bit then on about how they viewed themselves, if they ever kind of had any interesting kind of, I don't know, views of their identity or their kind of belonging in where they were?
The children were brought up in England, very much part of British society. But each child had sort of their own view. But Bamba was very, very fiery, especially towards the end of her life, towards the end of her life. Wrote excessively to the India office, to the British,
claiming that she was the rightful heir and sovereign of the Punjab, and if the Punjab or India is ever made independent, Punjab should be reverted back to her. Whereas someone like Frederick was very much different. He knew that the Punjab had been annexed and it had been 50, 60 years ago. It's all done and dusted. And he just wanted to live a peaceful life. He enjoyed his history. He enjoyed his archaeology. He enjoyed art, writing. And he focused most of his time and energy into that. And he really was a credit to East Anglia. I mean, they call him an Anglophile because that's what he was. And even till today, we're talking about nearly 100 years ago. He died 100 years ago, but he's still very much remembered. If you go to the village of Blownorton, people will talk about him like if it was only yesterday that he was there. They still remember and recall him and talk of him and say, "Oh, my father knew him," or "My mother used to talk about this and this story." So his history and the way he related to this was very much different to Bamba. Again, Sophia was obviously a very radical suffragette. Not only did she assist the Indians because she was there in the First World War, she nursed many of the Punjabi and Sikh soldiers at Brighton. She would raise funds for the Indian soldiers. She sent funds and gave to the charities in Punjab, in Jalandhar especially, to girls' schools, etc. But she also had a very she was a party girl. She loved the high society in Britain, very much part of the high society circle here as well. So she had a mix of both. So she wasn't that she was anti-British or pro-Indian. So she had found herself that middle level, whereas Bamba was more towards being a very pro-Punjabi person and really felt for what her family had lost.
It's really interesting because I'm certainly not aware of of what you've just described, and especially Bamba's letters to these Foreign Office and Indian Office and kind of requesting for Punjab to be granted back to her is something that's actually quite interesting. And something that I'm going to dig into a little bit later on as well, actually. Obviously, then we've spoken about the kids, but then just kind of taking it back a step and looking at Mahad Daleep Singh Ji, there's always this kind of contentious period at the end of his life where it's said that when he's in Paris, he's essentially kind of longing to get back to Punjab to try and somehow reclaim his kingdom. Now, obviously, you're perfectly placed to ask this question. What really went on? What was Maharaj Daleep Singh's views of what had taken place, especially towards the end of his life? Because there's some evidence to suggest he was essentially trying to get back to India to reclaim what had been annexed previously. So, yeah, if you could just kind of elaborate on what you would say happened.
Well, as we know, Daleep Singh's life could be best described as tragic, really. And as a youngster, his life was completely controlled by others. Some say you could call him a puppet. You had the Darbar pushing him this way, his uncle Jawar Singh pushing him the other way, the British wanting to control him. And the same thing happened to him when he, as he got older in his 50s, he found that the full sum or the promised pension to him was never being paid. He fell out with the British over his pension because the full sums weren't being received. And he basically took his family and tried to head to India. And as we know, he was arrested at Aden. And at that point, he sent his family back to England so he could sort of go on his rebellion against the British Empire. And again, when he arrives in Paris, because he's not allowed to go to India, so he arrives in Paris, and then you've got the Irish Fenians pulling him one way, you've got German intelligence, the French underworld, and the agents of the Russian king enticing him to Russia. So again, he was a puppet. Again, everybody wanted to use the Maharaja for his own gains. And a promise, which was put forward to him, was that if you come to Russia, the King of Russia will give him 20,000 soldiers to march into India via Afghanistan. The Irish Fenians would get the Irish regiments in the British Indian Army to rebel at the rear, and the Sikhs in the Indian Army would rebel when they see the Maharaja facing them. I mean, it was a ludicrous plan. It was never going to happen. And when the Maharaja did arrive in Moscow, he found out that the agents, in particular Agent Katkov, who was going to arrange for him to meet the Tsar of Russia, had died. So it was another plan which was scuppered. The Maharaja came back to Paris, and at that point, his health took a nasty turn. He had a stroke, and that was the decline of the Maharaja, and he ended up dying in Paris. So he never actually got to go to India. But I think the whole idea of actually causing or starting this rebellion was a fantasy for him. It was never going to happen.
No. Thank you for providing that, because just with every question that you've answered so far, the answer is just far more interesting and deep than I expect. And I'm absolutely enjoying this. So obviously we've spoken about how you kind of first got into things, and these adverts in the newspapers, or these kind of letters to the editor, so to speak, helped you kind of start your collection and your interest in this part of history. Now, obviously doing some reading for this podcast, your collection of artifacts and antiques, amongst other things, includes Dilip Singh's clothing, letters, diaries, photo albums, personalized household objects. In fact, it's close to probably more than 1,000 items, which you have generously loaned to the world's top museums, including the British Museum, Kensington Palace, and the V&A. And obviously these exhibitions have given the public an opportunity to view these artifacts, memorabilia, which have never seen before, and which were hidden away in people's private collections or just in people's houses or kind of wherever. Now, I could imagine, and to me in my head right now, I'm just thinking of your collection sounds something like putting me in a candy shop. Like, it just sounds absolutely brilliant. But just kind of putting that to one side, could you kind of tell us perhaps about some of the most interesting items in those collections, or kind of some of the most less known items and how they relate to certain individuals?
Yeah, sure. So I think an interesting object is the personal notebook of Maharaja Dilip Singh, which I obtained from the granddaughter of the Maharaja's, from Princess Bamba's personal companion. And what's interesting about this handwritten notebook, it's got not only his finances, so again, it's showing that side of the Maharaja where, you know, he was born a king of a prince of Punjab who was destined to be the successor of Ranjit Singh. And here is a man writing his finances of what's coming in and what's coming out. So he's had to control his money. But the most interesting page comes halfway through the book, when the Maharaja lists the names of the Ranis of Maharaja Ranjit Singh. So he makes this list of around, in this book, he's made a list of around 53 Ranis, Maharanis of Maharaja Ranjit Singh. And on the side of those names, he's put the names of the children of Ranjit Singh, or the, i.e. the sons. But what's really special is that he mentions the daughters of Ranjit Singh. And that's something we never talk about. We always talk about the seven sons or the sons of Maharaja Ranjit Singh. But in history, we always tend to, especially in Indian history, we always tend to mention the female line and the women. And the fact that this mentions the daughters, it shows that Ranjit Singh did have daughters. That's a very interesting object for me, because I think it shows, you know, we're all human, and that we should talk about, and more research should be done into the daughters of Ranjit Singh, who are not even mentioned in contemporary books, even which were written by the British who visited the Lahore Darbar. So it's obviously they were kept back, but they were there. So that's one of my key objects, which I love. And I've exhibited this at Thetford Museum. And it was also exhibited just before the COVID pandemic last year for a year at Kensington Palace, when they had the Queen Victoria Bicentenary Exhibition.
Another item, another favorite item of mine is the Purdy hunting gun of Maharaja Daleep Singh. He had a set of three guns, and this is gun number three in its original box. And I've been tracking these guns for years. I knew these guns existed. I even found somebody who had owned all three guns, which were found actually in one of the houses belonging to Princess Bamba. And all three guns had been sold in the 1960s for around £50, which was quite a reasonable sum at that time. The three guns were sold for £50 to a local farmer who then sold the other, kept the one he liked and sold the other two. And I actually met the farmer, I did, about 20 years ago. And he said to me, God, I used that gun, and it was the gun had such a smooth action. And he told me that the other two had sold. And I finally tracked the third one down in the States. And I actually contacted the chap, and I said, no, would you sell the gun to me directly? And he was like, oh, no, this is, you know, I've been told that this is Daleep Singh's gun and it's worth a lot of money and blah, blah, blah. And I want it to go to auction. So he put it in auction, and I think he put it in the wrong auction because nobody bid on it. And I ended up buying it less than 25% of what I had offered to him for the gun. So that was a real feather in my cap. And it's actually a beautiful piece. This is a proper exhibition piece, and each piece has got a serial number. And the Purdy gun is actually, we can call it the Rolls Royce of guns. This gun, when it would take around a year to make, it was handmade guns. Purdy still make the same sort of handmade guns, and it would be the equivalent of that time, around 3 years' wages to buy one gun. So it just showed you how much workmanship and what the price was to have this bespoke gun made, because it was made around the actual person. So it's according to your arm span, your height, your body weight. So everything will be taken into account, and this gun will be made around you to suit you. So it's a very personalized item.
It's just amazing how detailed and rich kind of the history is. One thing, though, that I just wanted to ask you, just going back to the first example that you had of the notebook, is then, in your estimation, how many wives do you think Maharaja Ranjit Singh Ji had? And then how many sons and daughters do you think he had in total?
Well, the notebook, Daleep Singh himself in his hand mentions 53.
So 53 wives.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, and how many sons and daughters then?
So there's seven sons, and I believe there's four daughters that I mentioned. I believe it's four. And over the years, I've been told that there was an eighth son, and I've actually met the descendants of this so-called eighth son as well. It's very hard because obviously it's very difficult to do any DNA testing, etc. But it's something which, maybe for future scholars to look at, I think certainly to go down and find out who these daughters were and their names, because sadly the names are not mentioned of the daughters, just that they were daughters from such and such Rani.
Okay. No, understood. Now, another question that is more kind of general in its scope, and something that I've actually pitched to a couple of people that I've had the pleasure to talk to on the podcast. So Davinder Tur, who's another collector, Amandeep Madra, who obviously you're more than well aware of these characters. And it's also quite a topical question at the moment because of this entire debate about giving things back or not. Now, I'm more than aware that within Sikh history, not everything that's in a museum in the UK has been stolen or has been taken by force. And I think the story of kind of the annexation of Punjab and what happens to Ranjit Singh's lineage is quite, I guess, in a sense, quite illustrative of what we're talking about. But in your kind of estimation, what do you think is a practical way of kind of answering this question about whether items that have been taken from India should be repatriated or should be returned to whoever it is that they should be returned to? And again, don't ask me who that is, because I don't think there's an answer to that. And I'm also more than aware that there's loads of practical problems. So for argument's sake, I think returning certain things to India, there'll be huge question marks over its kind of preservation and conservation. On top of that, I think then there's also questions of, well, like, who do you return it to and how far back do you go? Because if you take the Koh-i-Noor, for example, like, it has belonged to people prior to Ranjit Singh. So to claim it is just a Sikh item, quote unquote, would be kind of stopping at a particular point. But putting all of that aside, and especially for someone like yourself in the position and with the research that you've done, kind of, what do you think would be a positive outcome out of this debate, or what are your kind of opinions on how this should develop?
So to answer your first part, are all items which are sold or Punjab or Sikh interest stolen, looted, or taken from the Punjab? And I would say no. And it's probably, I couldn't put a percentage in it, but I think it's probably less than 50%. Many of the items actually were sold. Even the items from the Lahore Treasury were sold, auctioned at that time. And obviously many officers and generals purchased items as well from the Lahore cells. But also many of the other stately rulers, the other Punjab chiefs and Maharajas of India, purchased items to associated with the Punjab and Maharaja Ranjit Singh. And what we saw in 1947 after partition, many of these princely houses suffered at the consequence of independent India, and their wealth, their revenues, their incomes were greatly reduced. And many of them sold items in the 50s and 60s in England. So they came back to the England, the items were shipped here and sold either privately. I've met princely houses where collections of arms and armor were sold privately, even like guns, etc., were sold to military dealers. And these items are now sort of coming up, and they hold a great value because at that time, these princely rulers just wanted money just to survive. So that's how many of the items ended up here. And obviously you have items which were sold by former governor generals. Now we can argue, were they stolen? Were they gifted? Were they given? Because there were a lot of gifts given by the princes as well. Not just the princes in the Lahore Darbar, not only the courtiers, like, for example, Raja Dhyan Singh, who was the prime minister, he gave gifts to British generals, etc., as to get favors in return. So there were, and we've got records of these gifts being given, and I've seen Providence notes where certain Sardars in the Lahore Darbar had given gifts to the British. So we can't say that everything that comes up was stolen or looted from the Punjab and it should go back. Now, the question about going back, I obviously believe that items should stay here because I think they're looked after, they're preserved here. We have the facilities here, the museums, which can display them. For example, the golden throne of Ranjit Singh. Now, if that was in India or in Punjab, do you think that would be in the same condition that it is today?
No,
I don't know. I don't think it would. No, it'd probably be melted down by now.
Yeah, I was just about to say
items of jewelry.
Yeah, broken up and dispersed. Yeah.
Yeah, I can tell you a really interesting story, which I was actually going to say for the Sikhs in Britain part. But during the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, one of my grandfather's brothers was peddling in Norfolk. And he knocked on this lady's house and to sell his wares. And she said, please come in. And when he went inside, she had behind the sofa, sitting on leaning against the wall, an oil painting of Dalip Singh, Maharaja Dalip Singh. And he said to her, this is our great king. This is Dalip Singh. This is the Maharaja of the Sikhs. And she told him that her grandfather had known Dalip Singh, etc., and that's how she had ended up with this painting. So my grandfather's brother said, well, I'd be happy to buy this, you can have my wares, don't pay me, just let me have the painting because it means so much to me. And the lady agreed and she gave him the painting for the objects he was selling. And he brought the painting back to Ipswich, where my mother was born. And my mother remembers seeing that painting, and the painting was at her house for around 6 months, where her uncle had stored it until such time he could take it to India. And a year later, he took the painting back to India, and he gave it to the Bangla Sahib Gurdwara. Now, we tried so much afterwards to go to Bangla Sahib Gurdwara and find out what happened to this painting, and nobody knows. So this painting, which was firstly given, is gone missing. So it just shows you that, you know, the cataloguing, the, you know, the safety of these items. And now I wish that painting had stayed here, because I think it would have been, you know, we would have known which location it is. It would have been displayed. Had they maybe even taken it to the Thetford Museum, it might still be on display there. So it's sad, because it's something we've lost now, and maybe one of the committee members has got it hanging up in his house. So...
No, I can. I think that's a perfect example, really, of some of the worries about kind of the practical implications of sending things.
Yeah, and even like the golden throne of Ranjit Singh. I mean, every year they take the chair out for investigating, for checking it, and for any deterioration, and they conserve it. Which is immense, because you only have to go to the Punjab and see the items they've got in the museums and the condition they're in, yeah. And the way they handle it. For example, I gave my the Dalip Singh jacket. I've got a jacket belonging to Maharaja Dalip Singh, which I gave to Hampton Court when they were doing an exhibition. And they took the jacket in, and at about a month later, they sent me a report of all the restoration work that needed to be done for this jacket to be displayed at the palace. And I was like, well, how much is this going to cost me?
Yeah.
And they said, no, it's not going to cost you a penny. We are going to get all this work done for you, because we want the jacket to be in pristine condition when it goes on display. And they literally spent thousands of pounds on my jacket to get it preserved.
Insane.
And now tell me who does that?
Yeah,
what country does that?
Yeah.
And that's when some other country's heritage, I mean, I can't see Punjab doing that on their own heritage. And here we have, you know, a British palace, we've got Hampton Court spending money on conservation on a Sikh item.
Well, I guess you only have to look at some of the Kar Seva that's happened at some of these Gurdwaras or at some of these Bungi over the years, and how kind of these age-old frescoes of these kind of beautiful paintings of the Gurus or other scenes are just tiled over. And I think that kind of goes to show the attitude really in Punjab towards preservation of culture and heritage. And I think you're right, really. I don't disagree with anything you said. I think the UK, the level and standard that is applied to these things is just beneficial for everyone involved. So yeah, can't knock.
There is, and I'll just give you a little another nugget which might interest you, is that in Amritsar, right behind the Ram Gariya Bungas, we have the two towers. In the bazaar, there was used to be a bakery. And I went there about 5 or 6 years ago. A friend of mine had told me that this bakery was part of an old haveli belonging to one of the Ram Gariya Sardars, one of Jasa Singh's cousins or brothers. And I went to the chap, and he said to me, yeah, come on, I'll show it to you. So he took me to the back, opened this old haveli up, and it took me upstairs, and literally this building was on its last legs. You know, it was so weak. When we went upstairs, we could only walk around the edges. He told me not to walk in the center of the room because the floor was actually going to collapse. And it was literally covered in frescoes. I mean, floor to ceiling in frescoes, Sikh frescoes. It was a Hindu guy who actually owned the bakery. And the ceiling was like the Sheesh Mahal, all those little mirrored ceiling, all done in gold. It was absolutely beautiful. It was very similar to the Patiala Palace, the Sheesh Mahal Palace in Patiala. And he told me that he had gone to the SGPC, had spoken to the Golden Temple and said, look, I've got this building. This is your history. You should be saving this. You know, take this from me, you know. They weren't interested. And I went there about a year or 2 years later, and the building had gone. It had been demolished, and a new development had been put on its place. So just shows you, and that's on the footsteps of the Golden Temple, right outside, you know, literally a 30-second walk. So it just shows you how we don't, no, we're not putting that effort in now into our own heritage, which is on our footstep and on our doorstep. And that's something we really need to analyze and look into.
No, definitely. I just think that it's insane, really, the attitude towards preservation of our own culture and history, especially from those institutions that you would expect to know better. But anyway, putting that aside, let's come back to then, obviously, kind of Mara's the Leap Singh, the Sikh royal family is what I think I'm going to title this podcast, because it kind of works quite well. So in doing some research and kind of pulling some of the questions together for this podcast, there were just a few really in relation to some of the nuances of Ranjit Singh's family. So for argument's sake, I came across the fact that the grave of Prince Victor and Anne the Leap Singh are at Monte Carlo. Now, I just wanted to find out, how did they end up there? And why, why did they end up there? Why are they buried there? And who are they really as people, kind of? Because I think some people listening might not necessarily be aware of how they relate to Maharaja Ranjit Singh Ji.
Right, so Victor Dalip Singh was Maharaja Dalip Singh's elder son, and Anne was Victor's wife. She was the daughter of the Earl of Coventry, and Alice Blanche. And an interesting story, actually, I'll tell you an interesting story. When I was researching the Dalip Singhs, Victor was one of the family members, one of the children, who we did not know. We did not know what happened to him. We didn't know where he had died and where he was buried. We knew the location of pretty much all of the other children, but Victor was the elusive one. And just during my research, I tracked down a distant cousin of the present Earl of Coventry. And this chap was in his 80s, and we became very good friends. We started communicating regularly by letter and conversing on the telephone. And during that time, he told me that he was the only surviving person who had actually attended the funeral of Lady Anne, who was his great aunt. And he said Anne was living with my family towards the end of her life. She had become elderly, that they had no the Leap Singh's son Victor and Anne never had any children, and after Victor died, she came to live with his family. So the first question I put to him is, how comes Victor and Anne never had any children, because they were married for the best part of 20 years? And he said, funny enough, I asked that question to my auntie myself, he said. And he said, my aunt said to me, I've never told anyone this before, but when I got married, Queen Victoria called me to Buckingham Palace, and she made me swear that I never give Prince Victor an heir, and that I should take him away out of England, take him away from England. And she said, I kept my oath and my queen's command till the end. And that was Lady Anne's words. So that we know that Prince Victor and Anne, after they got married, they settled in Paris. Victor was actually quite a gambler. He was an addicted gambler. He liked bridge playing. He liked playing cards with heavy stake card games, and he loved the casinos. And if you like casinos, there's nothing better than Monte Carlo. So he spent a lot of time in Monte Carlo, and he had actually decided when he dies, he wants to be buried in Monte Carlo. And for that purpose, he had bought a special plot in Monte Carlo, which was like an exclusive cemetery for the rich and famous. And I never knew this at the time. I never knew Victor was buried there. And I obviously asked when I spoke to this distant cousin of the Coventry family. He said, well, yes, I went to Lady Anne's funeral in 1956, and that's when Anne died. But he goes, I was only a young boy, a young teenager. But I remember it was on the hill overlooking Monte Carlo, the sea at Monte Carlo. And that's all he could remember, because he obviously had never gone back. So I, at that time, was at university, and I had a French foreign exchange student working, studying with me. And I asked her to translate a letter. I wrote a letter which I wanted to write to the mayor of Monaco, and to find out, you know, where Victor's grave would be. And she translated the letter for me and sent the letter, and she actually put her address on it because he would contact her. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, she had a reply from the mayor of Monaco that or from his office that they had located the grave, and both Anne and Victor were buried there, and they were actually inviting me to come and see it. So if I want to come out to the south of France, they would personally give me a tour of the place. And this was in 2003, just in time for my first book. I flew out there for a weekend, and they were really interested to know more about Victor, because this was a grave which nobody attended to, and they knew very little about Prince Victor. And they actually wanted to shift all the graves at that time from this exclusive graveyard, which originally had been right on the outskirts of the town. But obviously, over the course of 100 years, the graveyard has, the town had expanded, and this graveyard now lie right in the center of town. And they wanted to shift all the graves, and they were looking for the various descendants to get their permissions. So that was another box which was ticked when I finally discovered where Victor was buried.
So during the research, I also found that you were quite instrumental in uncovering the gravestone of Mahadani Jinder at Kensal Green. And I just wanted to, and also in the restoration process of that. Now, I just wanted to find out, how did you go about finding it, first of all? Because I think that's quite, just like the Prince Victor gravestone, it's quite a remarkable thing to discover. But then secondly, the restoration process, like, what is involved in that?
Well, with the Jinder one, it was quite the reverse, because I actually never found Jinder's gravestone. I think the gravestone found me. I had a call one day from Kensal Green Crematorium, because they were undergoing restoration works at one of their chapels, the Dissenters Chapel, which is the non-believers chapel. Now, I always knew Jinder had a service here in the UK, and then her body was laid to rest temporarily until Maharaja Dilip Singh got permission to take his mother's remains to India for its last rites. And I knew that that place where she had been, or her coffin had been stored, was Kensal Green. So basically, her body had been stored in the catacombs, which are in the basement part of the Dissenters Chapel. At that time, it actually, during the Victorian era, it was very fashionable, rather than burying the dead, to actually store their coffins in catacombs, which, so they would literally be stacked in specially made shelves, and people would go to visit their sort of deceased relatives or loved ones and sit beside them, and maybe read a book or whatever, and spend time. So that's where Jinder's remains were kept. But obviously, after the Victorian era finished, that sort of became, you know, it fell into disrepair. The chapel was falling to bits. The catacombs were actually raided by people who wanted to loot the coffins for metal, for iron, etc. A lot of the coffins were actually broken up, and the chapel obviously was going through extensive renovation work. And when they were doing the restoration, they're clearing up the catacombs, they found a part of a slab, which was a marker for one of the graves, which had some Gurumukhi writing. And because it was, and they obviously went down their records, and they found that there was only a handful of Indians who had been kept at that time in that catacomb. They'd contacted me saying, "We think we found a gravestone. We think it might belong to Maharani Jinder Kaur." And they sent me a picture, and straight away I could read Punjabi. Jinder Kaur was actually written on this slab, just half a piece. And I showed it to my father, and now he translated it fully for me. And I said, "No, you need to find the rest of these pieces, because it's amazing. We need to put this together." So they found another two pieces. Unfortunately, they didn't find one corner, which is still missing. I went down to visit them at Kensal Green, and we had to put on special suits to go down to the catacombs. Quite freaky, but there was literally dozens of coffins which were just been smashed and where caskets, iron caskets had been had stolen. And there were just bags and bags of these black bags were lying in the corner. And I said, what are these? And they just said, they're just body parts and stuff. And I was quite freaked out. So they showed me the exact spot where Jindal's coffin had been kept, and then showed me the parts of the fragments of the stone. It's a large, I would say about, or a 2 foot by 2 foot stone. And I arranged for this to be restored. We sent it to a monumental memorial chap to put the stone pieces together. And we had it cleaned. Literally, it was black. These were underground for around 150 years. Because what had happened, obviously, when the Leipzig came to take his mother's remains to India, the marker had been smashed, the body had been taken out, the coffin had been taken out, and then these slabs had just been thrown to one side. And miraculously, they had stayed there under these catacombs and not thrown away or disposed of, but they were just thrown aside in one corner of this chapel. So we had this restored, and then I spoke to the chapel. I said, "Look, what's your aim? What are you going to do with this with this stone?" And they said, "Well, Peter, you've restored it. We'd be happy to go with whatever you think is right, because it's of no use to us." And I arranged. I went to quite a few of the other mainstream museums, such as the British Museum and the V&A. They were all happy to take the gravestone, but none of them would guarantee that it would be displayed. And I thought, that's not what I want. I want this item, this artifact, to be shown, because it should be on display, because we don't have many, there's only a handful of objects which belong to Maharani Jindgaur, and this was one of them, and it should be on display. And I spoke to Thetford Museum, which was the museum founded by the Leipzig son. And they said, "Oh, we'd be more than happy to take this and we'll put it on display." And that was part of the agreement which I reached them. And they've had it since 2008. For the last 13 years, it's been on display at Thetford Museum.
That is an absolutely amazing story. And I think one thing that I've really enjoyed so far is that each time I ask you a question, I get an answer that's
really long.
It's more and more interesting. So I kind of expect a particular answer, and then I get something that is just completely left field, and I'm like, wow. Just then continuing. So one of the other graves that you were able to locate was that of Princess Pauline. Now, I have no idea who this is, and I'm sure a lot of people listening aren't necessarily aware of who she is and how she fits in terms of her lineage from Mardar Jindjit Singh. So before kind of going in to explain how you were able to locate her grave, who is she and how does she fit into everything?
So Princess Pauline is Maharaja Daleep Singh's daughter from his second marriage, when he married Ada. He had two daughters. One was born in Russia, one was born in Paris, Pauline and Irene. And Pauline lived most of her life. She got married. She actually married a soldier who actually died in the First World War. And she died. Let me rephrase that. She actually disappeared during the Second World War. And none of the other family members knew what happened to her, because obviously France was an occupied, but partly occupied territory during the war. And she just went off the radar. And in the 1950s, Professor Gundar Singh was an eminent historian of Patiala University, visited Princess Bamba in Lahore, and he interviewed her and asked about the whereabouts of her siblings. And Princess Pauline was the one that she could not give a date of death for, or where she died. And over the years in books, all we said is that she died during the Second World War, probably died in a concentration camp. And that's what I probably believed as well, because I thought that's the sort of the answer, because it's either in a concentration camp, or she died like a labor camp, or she died during the bombing when France was being bombed. A few years ago, I think it was 2016, a chap who was researching Princess Pauline's husband's family contacted me, said that he was doing his family history, and Princess Pauline, it wasn't called Pauline, it was called Pauline Torrey, because she'd married Colonel Torrey. Pauline Torrey's name had come up. And obviously when he Googled it, he found out there was the Leipzig connection, and he got in touch with me. And I was so excited when he said that. And I said, well,
have you got a date of death? He goes, well, yes, because in the family, there's a death certificate. And I thought, well, that's all I need. So once I got the date of death, I was able to find out her exact location in Paris where she had died. So we knew it was France, but she actually died in a place called Pau, P-A-U. And I contacted the crematorium, obviously delved into it much more deeper and found out that the crematorium lies next to a sanatorium. And a sanatorium was a place in those days where people were sent to who had TB, where at that time TB, tuberculosis, was not, if you had TB, you wouldn't recover for it. And you were sent to a sanatorium to basically live out your last days or keep away or be kept in quarantine from the rest of the people. She had got TB during the war. She had died. And then she was buried in the cemetery next to the sanatorium. They couldn't even contact a member of her family. The war was on. Even her belongings were not collected from the sanatorium, which were later went missing or thrown away. So I worked closely with the cemetery, and then we found out that obviously these particular bodies were these sanatorium victims, because they were just basic burials with a marker. After that, because there was no families or nobody to ask about them, they were all removed and they were put into a mass grave. So sadly, her remains were removed out with all the other victims of TB from that era and put into one mixed or sort of mass grave. And obviously now they can't be identified. So all we know is that this is the area or the patch of the cemetery where her remains lie. They do lie there because they've got it on record. So now I'm in touch with the burial ground, and we was actually meant to go there last year, but it's going to be in 2022. We're going to arrange to put a memorial plaque to Princess Pauline, so she will be remembered, and people will know that this is Maharaja Ranjit Singh, Maharaja Ranjit Singh's granddaughter and Daleep Singh's daughter. He's buried in this small corner of France, which is really a sad story, a sad end Princess Pauline's life.
Just continuing then with this kind of commemorating these individuals from Maharaj Ranjit Singh to his family, one of the things that I came across that you're currently working on is a statue to Prince Frederick and Princess Sophia at Thetford. Now, I just want to ask you, why do you think that is important, and what is involved also in kind of getting this kind of from idea to it actually being there?
Well, the initial idea was the town council's idea. They refer to these three children in particular as the super siblings, the Daleep Singh super siblings, as I mentioned earlier. And they do thrive on the tourism they get on the back of the Daleep Singh story. And these three characters, obviously Frederick in particular, was a great benefactor to the town. He gave a lot to the town. And this is a way that the town can give something back to Frederick, you know, in his memory. And obviously with Sophia, with her suffragette story, the last couple of years, you know, her history has been really, really, really been told with not only the she's on the plinth of the suffragette statue in Parliament, but also she had a postage stamp to commemorate the Votes for Women movement, which came out a couple of years ago. And I think there's just been a general increase in people wanting to know more about Sophia Daleep. She's a very interesting character, a great feminist, a character of empowerment. And now with Catherine's story coming to light with her activities in saving these Jewish families from Nazi Germany, they want to have the whole three of them remembered in one monument. And obviously this will drive in tourism as well, not only sick, non-sick audience as well, but I think it's something for us all to go and visit, so we can, you know, we can remember them as well, and it's something which they will be, you know, immortalized in these statues. So I think it's nice that we you know, we're in an age where we're looking at toppling statues, that we've got statues of people we can relate to, which should be put up.
I like that a lot, and I think that's a brilliant way of really kind of summarizing that the why we should be doing certain things. And yeah, no, couldn't disagree. Now, this is a question that actually, I'm sure you're aware the UK Punjab Heritage Association put on these regular webinars. The other week they had one with Susan Strong, and she was discussing art within India, and obviously touched upon Sikh art within India, etc. Now, a question that popped up then, and this was actually from someone else who was watching this webinar that I remembered because I thought it'd be a good question to ask you, was, are you aware of any of Maharaj and Ranjit Singh Ji's family visiting any of the museums that would have then had his items on display? So for argument's sake, the example that was given in this webinar, the question that was provided was, considering Ranjit Singh's throne is already in London, did some of his grandchildren at any point see it or interact with it or know where it was? Or like, surely they would have been aware of something.
Well, we had the Indian Museum in Kensington, and Ranjit Singh's chair, Golden Throne, would have been on show there. And no doubt the princesses, who obviously had a London residence, would have seen it. I know much of the art collection, the Scherf painting collection, which is now in the Hall Fort Princess Bamba collection, was actually loaned by Princess Bamba to Kensington Museum, which was the sort of the Indian Museum at that time, before the V&A. So I'm not saying that she would have seen Sikh items, but certainly her Sikh collection, her family Sikh collection, she had personally loaned to the museums here. So quite the reverse of your question.
No, not a problem. I think that this is why it's interesting asking these questions, because you just don't know which way it's going to go. And actually, that's the fun of it. But no, fair. Just then, coming to an item that I think got a lot of people's attention, and this is also because for the amount that it sold for, is the Gibson statue of Daleep Singh, which eventually sold for 1.7 million by Bonhams, I think a couple of years ago. I think there's a similar statue of Maharaj Ranjit Singh Ji as well. But anyway, coming back to this one, I just wanted to get an idea of what your involvement was in relation to this statue and how you kind of helped the auction house in this instance.
Yeah, I knew about this statue for many years, because many of the former servants or descendants of former servants I'd interviewed and met over the years always spoke of this statue, and I was always trying to look for it, always trying to hunt it down, and I never knew it would pop up into auction before I found it. I actually remember a couple of years before it came up in auction, I was contacted by somebody on Saturday evening saying that they have the Daleep Singh bust. And I was like, oh my God, I found it. And I said, where are you? And I said, I'll come and see you in the morning. I drove down Sunday morning and went to Norfolk and went to their farmhouse. And they bought this statue out, which was actually a statue of Sinbad the Sailor. And I was really disappointed that day. So that's how eager I was to see or find this Gibson statue. And when Bonham actually contacted me when it actually came in, they invited me down to come and look at the statue. And it was the most beautiful piece of sculpture that I had seen. It was huge. You know, it took actually three or four men to actually lift this statue. That's how heavy it was. And I had quite a few images in my collection of that statue, where it was on display in Blow Norton Hall in one of the attic rooms. It was also on display later on in Princess Bamba's house in the garden. It was on a pedestal. She had it outside. And so I helped with some of the research, and I started sort of, because we knew now where the statue was, I started to sort of find out what happened after Bamba died. And this statue popping up in auction in 2007. And I actually found out after Bamba died in 57, the statue was actually left on a pedestal in the front garden of the house. And it was there for around 20, 25 years. And this was in the village of Blow Norton, and nobody batted an eyelid. Nobody took any notice of it. And then what happened was that
in the late 70s, the owner of the cottage, her son was an alcoholic. And he tried to sell this bus to the people in the local village or in the local pub for about £50, but there were no takers. Nobody wanted to buy this statue. And I was actually giving, I was actually giving a talk in the village of Blownorton about this bus. And I was telling people, I was saying, you know, that this statue had belonged to your village and it was offered for £50 and it sold for 1.7 million, but nobody in this village purchased it. And all of a sudden, this chap stood up. This is about 10 years ago. He stood up and he said, an elderly chap in about 85 years old. And he said, excuse me, but I was offered that marble bust for £40 by Mr. Crow. But I refused the statue because I thought it was a voodoo doll. So I never purchased it. He said, Mr. Vance, you know what? If I had bought it for £40, it would be sitting in my barn right now. And I would say to you, come with me right now and you can take it home. And that was the exact words, and I actually cracked up. So the statue actually went to auction, and I remember saying to the auction house, I said, look, you valued it at 25, but if an offer of £100,000 came, would you take it? And they said, well, we would, but we think just the interest and the publicity the statue is generating is just too much. You know, it's worth much more in publicity. And literally, I think the opening bid was £100,000, and the hammer fell at 1.7 million. And I think we was all shocked at that time. I believe it went to a member of the Qatar royal family. So it's not, unfortunately, didn't get into Sikhs. Well, I knew a few Sikhs which were bidding for it at that time.
So the statue of Manoj Dilip Singh Ji is now sat in some Qatari king. Princes.
I believe so. It was an anonymous buyer, but the rumours that I heard were that it had gone to a Qatar family here, who specifically wanted it because it was an Oriental figure. It was a figure with a turban, not because it was.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, I can imagine. Wow. Okay. No. Insane. Yeah. 1.7 million as well. Wow. How much do you think, like, so putting aside the fact that obviously the publicity and the interest helped to lift the price, but like for what it's worth, like how much do you think it is like kind of truly valued? I don't know if that's even a question that's answerable, but kind of at an estimate level, like do you think it was worth that kind of?
No, at that time it was, I mean, what the valuation they'd put at it, I think 25 to 30,000 was probably what the statue was worth at. 50,000, if you want to say yes, it's a Dilip Singh statue and you really want to pay over the top for it. So it went well over its asking price. But as I said, it was the publicity which it caused. And I think that had a knock-on effect on a lot of the Dilip Singh items thereafter. People all of a sudden thought, hold on, we've got something of the Dilip Singh. That must be worth, you know, that must be worth millions too, you know. And that was the general perception. It was a chap who had known me for many years, and he had Prince Frederick's Purdy gun. And I always said to myself, look, if you ever want to sell it, you know, contact me, I'll be happy to buy it. And then after that bus sold at Bonhams, his daughter contacted me and said, Mr. Vance, my father's put the gun in Bonhams, you know, if you're after buying it. So I said, look, tell your father to sell it to me directly. I'll give him X amount of money. And she said, no, we think it's only fair it should go to Bonhams. And it sold for much less than what I offered them. And a couple of years later, when I went down to the village to do my research, I bumped into that same chap. And he couldn't look at me in the face. And I said, John, what's the matter? And his friend said to me, like, he just feels embarrassed because his family had forced him to put that gun in auction, thinking, you know, well, the bus sold for 1.7 million. So would this gun? And it literally didn't. It made a fraction of what they thought. And he said, I should have just given that gun to Peter, you know, because it meant more to him because he's the one who's researching the Dilip Singh, and he would have collected it part of the Dilip Singh collection. And it would have gone with the other items. So he said, I know, that was his own words. And I said, look, never mind, you know, these things happen. See, for me as a collector, I'm a very different collector than some collectors who will go to an auction house and it's like, you've got to buy this at any cost. For me, the buzz is in finding the item, not only at a bargain, but actually researching it, sourcing it, and getting it and saying, look, wow, I've discovered this. No one's seen it. It's not been seen in public, but I've managed to source it and get its history. So it's about, the buzz for me is finding the bargain in the Sikh items, not just going into an auction, which I find a bit boring. And you end up paying silly money.
Yeah. Yeah, I can well imagine as well. Well, that sold for 1.7 million. And to be honest, from the limited kind of research that I've done over the last few months in relation to just kind of looking at some of the items sold by auction houses in relation to Sikh art and history, they tend to go for way, way, way over the reserve price that they're given. And so, yeah, it's not surprising then to hear the same thing happened with this bust. Okay, now then, just kind of coming to kind of the last and probably the most juicy topic really in amongst all of this in relation to the kind of the heirs and descendants of Maharaja Ranjit Singh Ji is, and I'm sure a lot of people listening are probably waiting for this part because you've been posting a few bits and pieces about these so-called illegitimate heirs to the Sikh Empire. So I just wanted to get a little bit more information then about what you know about some of these descendants.
They were born not from the family. They were born out of wedlock, or they didn't come from the line from the marriage. So that's why they're referred to as illegitimate heirs to the family. But some really interesting cases have come to me over the years, over the last 20, 25 years. Not only from illegitimate children of Maharaja, but also of his sons as well, of Victor and Frederick's descendants. So I think some of the ones I put up was Sid Hammond, which was a really interesting chap because he was one of the first ones I went to see in 1997, who still lived in Thetford, only a couple of miles from Elverden. And he strongly believed that Daleep Singh was his great-grandfather. And he showed me keepsakes, which the family had been given. He'd shown me a picture of his... Although he looked very English, but his daughter was actually looked very Asian. So it skipped a generation. But his father also had black hair, but his grandfather didn't. So sometimes it showed a little skipping of generations. But when they were young, he would tell me that they would be called, the school children would tease them as the young princes. And that's when he questioned his parents, asking them why, or questioned his mother, why they were called the princes. And he said, well, the rumor was it that your grandfather was a child of Daleep Singh. His great grandmother had worked as a maid at the hall, and it said that she had come home expectant one day. And like it was with those times and those houses where servants did get pregnant, they would be looked after by the lords or whatever, who were the lords of the manors, and they would pay for the child's education. And sadly, the husband, if there was a husband, he would just basically get on with it and just treat the child and bring the child up as his own. So that was one of the cases which I invited, and that had a lot of response on Instagram. And there's been several others where people have discovered that an ancestor they've been researching all of a sudden has the middle name of Singh or Daleep. And they're like, "What? Where's this come from? Where's Singh and Daleep come from in our middle names?" And they've researched and found out that their ancestor before that had actually worked for Frederick or worked for Daleep Singh. And hence, they believe that maybe the child was born from the Maharaja or Prince Frederick, and the middle name was given of their father, of his respective father, and the education was also paid for. Some of them found out was paid for by the prince.
So, in total, how many illegitimate heirs and descendants have you so far been able to discover?
Well, I don't know how many are. Oh God, I don't know if how many are genuine, but I would say around a dozen have contacted me over the years, maybe a little bit more. Some I thought, okay, the story doesn't add up or the dates don't match up, but some of them were really, really looked really genuine. The images they sent me, there was one lady who sent me a picture of her grandmother, and she was a spitting image of Sophia. A spitting image, and I thought, wow. And they always believed that Frederick was their brother, was their great grandfather, and the family still believe that today. The Hammond family actually they're so adamant that every year the family gathers at the graveside to pay respects to the Maharaja. And there's about 50 members of the family now, but they all gather there because they believe that Dilip Singh was his ancestor. And they're not after anything. They're not after any sort of DNA testing or after any inheritance, but that is, you know, they've been told, and they strongly believe that Dilip Singh is their ancestor.
Out of those 12 or so, and even this last case that you've spoken about, like, how many of them do you think are more likely than not to be true? So I think the one that you spoke about, Sid Hammond, like, that kind of adds up, but...
His story did add up, his dates add up, and the chap was in his late 80s, 90s when he met me, and only recently his great-niece contacted me, and she's still following the story, so she's still adamant, and she's given me some more information and names and dates. And I believe it's very likely. Obviously, we can't be 100% unless there's some sort of DNA. But many of these families don't want DNA because they don't want to prove. They've got nothing to prove to anyone else. It's for themselves. They're happy with it. They're not after anything where they need to do a DNA test to prove anything. But there are some other descendants which we've come across. One or two very, very genuine cases, and without revealing too much, all I can say is watch this space, because something's going to be coming up soon, what we're working on, which is going to be for a major television channel. So it's a program we're working on, and I'll tell you more later on about it. So watch the space.
Nice. It sounds definitely really interesting. Now, just one last question before we wrap up this conversation, this topic about the Sikh royal family, as I think I'm going to call this podcast, is, so we've spoken about the illegitimate heirs, but in terms of the legitimate ancestry kind of from Maharaja Ranjit Singh Ji downwards, where does it end, and who is kind of the last surviving descendant from that lineage?
Well, because there's no, apart from the ones I mentioned, that the descendants that we have in the Punjab are not direct descendants. So there's many families, such as the Sandawalias, who were the cousins of the royal family. So their lineage goes much up higher up, you know, from Nord Singh and Bud Singh, Ranjit Singh's great-grandfather and great-grandfather. So there was obviously offsprings of the children of, for example, I've met descendants of Peshora Singh and Multana Singh, etc. But those were adopted, so they, you know, down the line they never had any children, so they adopted a child. They're not blood descendants, but they have that title where they are the descendants. They're known as the descendants of, say, Prince Multana Singh or Kashmir Singh, etc. But as for lineage, there's no direct descendants that we can say yes, that this is Ranjit Singh's, or in fact Dilip Singh's direct descendants. So probably the Sandawalis are probably the sort of the nearest ones we can get. But as I said, they're more cousins of the royal family. So you'll have to go much higher up the family tree say they're related.
Okay, no, that's really interesting. So I'm assuming that none of the Dilip Singh's daughters had any kids.
That's right. So it's quite ironic that the Maharaja had 8 children, and not one of them had an issue. So the family line, the direct family line, ceased when Princess Bamba died in 1957. So she was the, the last.
1957 isn't even that long ago as well, which is quite remarkable.
No, it's not. No, that's what I said when I was fortunate enough to do my research in the late 90s when I was at uni, and it was only 40 odd years after the princess's death. So there was still a lot of people around at that time who knew or remembered the princess, and they would sit, and I would sit with them, and they would talk like she was their best friend or whatever. No, it was amazing. You know, they could tell me so much personal stuff about the princesses, which you would not get in a book, you know, or in a record or whatever, or in any archival records office. So I think I was very lucky to get in there at that time, where there was so many people still alive who recollected the princesses.
There's just two things that I want to ask you actually before wrapping up. So the first one is there anything in particular that you have discovered or found out during your research and talking to all of these incredible people that you think is worth sharing? And secondly, for people listening who, and especially kind of like students or people kind of just leaving university and kind of thinking about getting into research and history and all the rest of it, kind of what would your advice be?
Well, when I started researching, as I said, purely accidental, but the sort of the goal I gave myself was that I need to find out what happened to all these children, because we, the eight children we knew, and we never knew where some of these died or where they died or where they were buried. And I wanted to establish, that's how I know where every child, no, the eight children, where they died and where they settled, etc. And thankfully, I did that. And for me, that was a great personal goal. But there's still so much missing in between. There's missing pieces of the jigsaw. There's timelines where we don't know, you know, what was Catherine doing all the time in the 20s and 30s in Germany? What was Pauline doing in Paris? Why did Princess Irene, the youngest daughter of Maharaja Dilip Singh, commit suicide off the coast of Monte Carlo in the 1920s? Now, what drove her to it? So there's so much still unanswered. And I hope that my, not only my books, but of the work I've done, inspires a whole new generation of researchers and enthusiasts who will delve into this and get to the bottom of many of these mysteries that we still don't know about. So that would, I would say to the next generation who are looking into a history and a Punjab and Sikh history, there's so much that we still don't know, and it'd be so good to find out, you know, these missing pieces. And obviously earlier I mentioned the daughters of Ranjit Singh, which is I think is another opening, another door which is open, and I think it really needs to be looked into, because that's something that we don't know about, and either it's been suppressed and it's sadly been forgotten. But now, you know, we're pushing for more sort of female and women stories. I think that's something we should focus on, and I think we should give that more its due attention.
No, definitely. And thank you. I've absolutely enjoyed this conversation.
Nice, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, and I know we've got another one lined up for later on, which we'll do soon as well, and we'll get that done. But I think I've really enjoyed this. I just want to check that there's nothing else that you want to include or mention or say before we kind of just wrap up.
No, I just want to say, well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, and it's now keep up the great work you're doing with these podcasts. It's not only for it, everybody can learn from it, myself as well. So I will now be keeping an eye on your podcasts as well and looking at them. And you know, it's a great service you're doing as sort of the new generation, you know, into glorifying and finding out more about our history. So keep it up, and thank you.
No, that's absolutely not a problem, and thank you. Like just nonetheless, I think I've really enjoyed it, and hopefully people listening to it will have enjoyed it, and yeah, definitely be in touch for the second part about Sikhs in Britain. So no, thank you.
Great.
For your evening.
All right. Okay.
All right. Sweet. Awesome. Take care.
Take care.
Goodbye.
See you later. Bye. Take care. Bye.